You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 48 is something like, what's the relationship between perception and knowledge? And we read Maurice Merleau-Ponty's The World of Perception from 1948, and his essay The Primacy of Perception and Its Philosophical Consequences from 1947. For links to these texts and other information, check out partiallyexaminedlife.com. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer, deducing the existence of you, the audience, from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, resentfully using his air conditioning in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allen in Boston, Massachusetts.
And this is Dylan Casey in Middleton, Wisconsin.
I want to start off by thanking our big dollar patrons since the last recording, which were Preston Haley, Brent Dahlgren, B. Boston, Russ Baker, Wilder Ramsey, and Michael Rissman. There is a suggested $1 donation for listening to this episode. Thank you to all of you who have paid that for the last one. Thanks also to those who bought my close reading file on Sartre. A bargain.
At twice the price.
We have some ground rules that we should probably express, but I would like Wes to express them. Do it.
I don't think I remember any of those.
How many episodes have you been on?
No name dropping.
I thought you were going to give your modified version of this. I thought you were going to give your interpretation.
His perspective?
I'd been able to prepare. You told me I'd be
no close. Preparation. Whimsy. People, if you look at our iTunes reviews, they say, we appreciate the whimsy. I think 40 people use those words, the whimsy.
That's, yes.
We will not assume that our audience has read this Merleau-Ponty reading, and
we will not name drop.
Just make your point. Don't say, you would understand me if only you had read Orson Welles' Death in the Cupcake.
That's not bad.
I didn't like it.
All right, Wes, what's the last one?
Be clear. Something like that. Unless it's more interesting not to be.
Yeah, that'll work. So, Merleau-Ponty, you want to give a sum up, Seth, what you thought was the major issue we need to discuss here?
I can tell you what my understanding from the shorter essay. When he says the primacy of perception, he means that our concept of consciousness should begin with understanding of human perception. Similar, I guess, of what Sartre was working on in The Transcendence of the Ego, which we just recently read, but with a little bit of a twist, I hope. I hope there's something more in there than what Sartre had to say.
Right. Isn't he normally cast as, well, kind of like Heidegger, but Heidegger didn't pay attention to the body.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he was friends with Sartre and writing at the same time as Sartre. And they, in fact, had a similar, they wrote about phenomenology, were highly influenced by Husserl at first. And then they got into Marxism later in their careers. This stuff is all from the pretty early part. The Phenomenology of Perception was his big book from 1945. And so both of these works are kind of dumbed down versions of it, right? The World of Perception is actually a series of radio lectures. So it's really dumbed down for a general audience from 48. And then before that, the Primacy of Perception, that essay was from a conference I see in November 46, where he's sort of presenting it to other philosophers. So it's basically a summary of the Primacy of Perception. And then it has a little like question and answer back and forth with these other guys. That was kind of interesting.
I had the same sort of been anxious to read Merleau-Ponty because of that, I guess, cliche positioning of him as expanding or extending Heidegger's phenomenology to the body. But from what I can tell, he must do most of that heavy lifting in something we didn't read.
What would it mean to do that?
What it would mean to do that was when Heidegger did the Analytic of Dasein, and he talked about the three different types of being in the world and what have you. He keeps talking about the Dasein, but he's talking about it in a very abstract way. And he doesn't talk about Dasein's experience of the body and how the body mediates the experience of being in the world.
So when Merleau-Ponty calls the primacy of perception, he says that perception is a nascent logos. So would that be the kind of thing that if he had done that, that would have gone in the direction you're talking about?
Explain what those two words mean and how they could fit together, how that phrase could be meaningful.
I'll just point you to the page and I'll expand. It's on page 101 in the Primacy of Perception essay, almost at the end. He says, right in the middle, by these words, the primacy of perception, we mean that the experience of perception is our presence at the moment when things, truths, values are constituted for us. That perception is a nascent logos, that it teaches us outside all dogmatism the true conditions of objectivity itself, that it summons us to the tasks of knowledge and action. It is not a question of reducing human knowledge to sensation, but of being present at the birth of this knowledge to make it as sensible as the sensible to recover the consciousness of rationality. So when I hear that perception is nascent logos, what I take him to be saying is that the way in which we perceive, and I suspect he would say other living things perceive, holds in itself logos. It's not super added. And that would be what it would mean to root rationality in the body. Is not to talk about it as electrochemical exactly, but to say that what logos is, what rationality is born out of and held within as a possibility in perception itself. And that by understanding and inquiring into perception authentically, we would understand our own logos better.
So he's rejecting a kind of neo-Kantian position where we're given these raw sensations, and then the logos part of it is given by the mind, let's say. Concepts are applied to structure experience. So this goes beyond the typical perception is theory-laden idea, because that seems to be already there in the neo-Kantian position, right? We perceive objects, and perception is theory-laden in the sense that concepts have already done their organizing work on the raw data of sensation. He seems to be trying to go a step further than that, right, and say what we're given is already laden with logos, and it's not the spontaneity of the mind that adds that. It's just there in the world, and we are present.
Well, it's there in us, right? It's there in our act of perceiving. I don't think he would say that it's there in
rocks. That's a good point.
Well, isn't it there in the world as revealed by phenomenological observation? So we saw that in Sartre, too, that it seemed like if you're just describing experience, then you just can't unpack what it is the subject is adding and what it is that is the object. Really, it just comes at you as this mass. So you end up pushing all these things like meanings, and even just seeing, we were saying last time with Sartre, that I could perceive something as sort of objectively hateful.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, if you just reflect on it a second, well, isn't it clear that it's just me that's doing the hating? It's not that the thing in itself is hateful. But no, really, unreflective experience, perception, just reveals these value terms, all these things, right as in the object of perception.
Yeah. We expand our notion of what an object is.
Yeah. And I just, from the beginning of the essay, he says, "We cannot apply the classical distinction of form and matter to perception, nor can we conceive the perceiving subject as a consciousness which interprets, deciphers, or orders a sensible matter whose ideal law it would possess. Matter is pregnant with its form, which is to say that in the final analysis, every perception takes place within a certain horizon and ultimately in the world, that both are present to us practically rather than being explicitly known or posited by us." I can understand sort of by looking at the way the words are put together and what those typically mean, how this might be kind of an anti-Kantian move, as Wes suggested, but I suspect it'd take a lot to kind of unpack that.
I think that he would say it might be an anti-neo-Kantian move, but later on, I think he wants to say that what he's doing is something that Kant himself might have left unfinished, but is directly in line with Kant and, in fact, Plato. He would call both those guys in line with what he's saying.
Hmm.
How is it in line with Plato? Because Plato seems to be doing exactly the opposite. Merleau-Ponty's chief antagonist in this is someone who sharply distinguishes the perceived world from the ideal world, the world as rationality grasps it. And so Plato's position is explicitly that perception is this sort of unreliable, decayed thing, and we have to apply our minds to sort of overcome these errors of perception. And we're using some sort of rational intuition, some faculty that we have to get at this, but it's not perception.
I don't want to be an apologist for Merleau-Ponty. I'm just saying that the place where he points to Kant and Plato is on page 95, but it is in the context of the question of contradiction. He would say that Plato and Kant hold the possibility of contradiction appears as a very condition for consciousness, and he juxtaposes them with Zeno or Hume, who demand a kind of explicit non-contradiction in consciousness as a proper condition for consciousness.
Yeah, that contradiction, I think he's talking about the, you know, if you look a little just before that, all of our experience of the world is through a tissue of concepts which lead to irreducible contradictions, the antinomies, if we attempt to take them in the absolute sense.
Can we give an example?
So yeah, one of the conditions of the possibility of experience is that I'm able to use the representation I think with any given experience. But if we treat that transcendental condition of consciousness as an object within consciousness, then we make the Cartesian move and we treat the ego as this object-like substance. And that is the mistake that Kant objects to. So the contradiction here is, on the one hand, we have to posit these sort of transcendental conditions of consciousness, but on the other hand, we can never call them objects and we can never have knowledge of them in the way that we have knowledge of empirical objects.
I was thinking that some of the contradictions that he's pointing to are easier to get at or less abstract. Like, he talks about the fact that things look far away, that they're smaller when they're far away. And he says early on in the essay that this is actually something that people didn't realize at first, that it sort of takes savages a while to understand this concept, right? Because they just grasp, look, there's the buffalo over there. And you have to actually step back and hold your thumb up and compare it to the buffalo to say, well, it looks like the buffalo is smaller than my thumb. Usually it's just, I just see the buffalo. So this was given as an example of people who say, look, we get all this sort of raw sense data where one of those would be small buffalo thing. Small colored thing. And then we interpret it. Oh, that must be a buffalo. And I interpret it as being close to me. He says, no, that's not actually how it works. We just see the buffalo as a buffalo because whatever's going on with this depth perception is just so internalized. Yeah. It's not something we have to think about.
This seems to me to be one of the things I found odd about Merleau-Ponty, because no one's claiming that we go through some conscious induction, you know, that we have to consciously prove to ourselves the size of the buffalo. All of that happens before anything is even experienced. And, you know, and brain scientists will talk about the same sort of thing. What the brain has to do to some raw data in order to interpret it in that way, it happens unconsciously, but it doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
I don't think that's what he's objecting to, Wes. I don't think it's a question of consciousness versus unconsciousness.
Well, he's objecting to the idea that there's this inference from sign to signify, that there's this inference from the raw data to the resulting object of perception.
I think his objection is more one about the way in which consciousness functions. He's definitely wanting to make a point against that consciousness is some kind of subjectivity that represents the world, and that perception is really a structured representation of this subject. Instead, he wants to say that perception is prior to the formation of the subject, in the sense that perception is the precondition for consciousness, and that somehow that makes it more primitive, and you don't go through whatever that move is that requires you to represent and do that move, whether it's conscious or unconscious. That's how I was seeing it.
So at this level, it sounds like perception is sort of this area of subject-object fusion. He's not objecting to the distinction ultimately between subject and object or to the sciences, at least that's what he says, right? And to that, at one level, yes, you treat subject and object as distinct and you go about the business of science and all of that. So the idea seems to be here that prior to all that, prior to that reflective distinction, there's this collapse of subject and object. He doesn't explicitly say that, but that's the way I thought about this concept of perception. When he's talking about the primacy of perception, it seems like it's a very unique conception of what perception is. It's not your everyday subject perceives object, where the subject-object distinction is intact. It's a more primary level out of which those distinctions come later.
By perception, he doesn't seem to mean the acquisition of sense information at extraordinarily raw level.
Right.
Definitely not.
One way that you could understand the activity of perception would be that you have, I mean, extraordinarily raw data coming into your mind, a processing unit. The colors that aren't even identified as colors, the lights and the sounds and the smells that aren't even identified with names. They're not even objects, that they're just literally electrical signals coming into some processing unit that then acts on them and creates objects out of them.
Right.
And my impression is that he wouldn't say that there is a distinction, properly speaking, between that raw sense data and the activity of consciousness.
Certainly nothing within phenomenological experience. You can't distinguish those. Yeah.
No, that's a good point, Dylan. There's a kind of good part on page 92, bleeding into 93.
Which text?
Primacy of Perception. What prohibits me from treating my perception as an intellectual act is that an intellectual act would grasp the object either as possible or as necessary. but in perception, it is quote unquote real. It is given, right, as this sum of a series of views, right? And so he then says, perception is a paradox in the sense that you can't have a perceived object without a perceiver. But at the same time, perception always involves, he says, a beyond of what is actually given.
Yeah, transcendent is what we talked about last time. Yeah.
Right, immanent versus transcendent. So the closest I can think, Dylan, to kind of characterize what he's saying when he talks about perception is what Sartre called unreflected consciousness, which we argued about at length in that episode.
Mm. Yeah, and just to, when he's talking about on the same page, the perceived thing is not an ideal unity in the possession of the intellect. It looks like he's responding to both the Cartesian view and the phenomenological view. So where the Cartesian view, Descartes' famous example of the wax, it can take on any number of different appearances or shapes. And so what constitutes an object isn't an object of our senses per se, but an object of some faculty of the intellect. And in the same way, for the phenomenologist, what we call the object isn't just the current perspective, you know, of my ottoman, the particular shape that's facing me. It's an infinite series of all the possible interactions I can have with the object, all the different perspectives I can take on it. The object is more than just this perspective. Anyway, I thought that was worth summarizing for people who haven't listened to previous episodes. So Merleau-Ponty is saying, actually, there is a sense in which the object is present in perception in the full sense. That perception isn't just the domain of this perspective and that perspective, and then the object is sort of this inferred ideal unity, mm-hmm. but the object really is there. I don't really understand that exactly.
Yeah, that was what we were arguing about, Wes, a little last time, is what this word transcendent, when applied to objects, means, because the historical meaning of the word is, it is, at least in part, it is beyond what we experience, right? Whereas the way I interpreted Sartre and the way I think Merleau-Ponty is explicitly saying here is that the world of perception, you might say, has the object in it. Whereas for Kant, there's an appearance and then there's, what is the real object that's causing the appearance? Who knows? But we wouldn't consider it the world of perception, the world that science ends up describing. So that it really truly is transcendent for Kant. But for these guys, they mean something else. And it is unclear.
There's the thing in itself. And then the object becomes a content of one's private experience. It's been constructed by the mind. And of course, the phenomenologists objected to this idea of objects being the contents of Seth's experience or Dylan's experience. It doesn't make sense. You get psychologism and mathematics. You need these entities to be public in some sense, to be available to everyone. So the object transcends experience in that sense, but it's still immediately available. Of course, the phenomenologist wants to say there's some sense in which, for Husserl, it's intuitively available, right? You can still intuit the object. It's just important that the object is not some content of some particular person's experience. It's transcended in that sense. And I don't know if Merleau-Ponty is exactly responding to Husserl and saying, well, that's still an ideal such and such, you know, you're intuiting this ideal mathematics. I think he is, because when he talks of geometry and mathematics, I think when Husserl, even though we have intuitive access to that transcendent object, this ideal unity of the infinite series of perspectives, that's sort of like a mathematical notion of what an object is. And Merleau-Ponty is saying, no, it's not like a mathematical object to which we have access through the intellect. We actually, through our body, through what we call perception with our body, have access to the object.
And isn't it that he's saying that the world that any perceiver has access to is the same world always? All perceivers have access to the same world. Their perceiving might be different because there's an infinite possibility of their perceptions. And he would also deny, along the lines of what Wes says, is that infinity is not such that you can sum it up and get hold of the object. It's not an infinite series that collapses.
Like an infinite number series. You can describe the natural number series.
Yeah, collapses isn't the right word. There's a different mathematical word, which is crazy that I can't remember it right now. But that all perceivers are accessing the same world out there. He would say that's all you can do. That's all that any perceiver can do. They all have access to one and the same world. And so whenever anybody is talking about their perceptions or talking about anything, they're always talking about the world. Then you get into this discussion about, well, at the very least, you're going to want to say that some of those renditions are more like knowledge or more like true than others, right? You're going to want to make distinctions on those perceptions.
Yeah, that becomes the problem.
Yeah. You're going to want to make distinctions that are more than the perceptual distinction, say, between the way a dog looks at the world and the way a human looks at the world.
How does a dog look at the world?
He wants to just say, look, whatever a dog sees is exactly the same world that I see and the same world that a madman sees.
The dog is just a little more excited.
And that a bee sees. All those perceptions are available from one world to things that perceive. There will be a range of distinctions to be made. I haven't read his big book, but I imagine you would say, well, look, one of those almost numerical distinctions that, look, dogs can hear in a different range of perceptions than human beings can hear. Or certain animals can see at different wavelengths than human beings can see at. And that those are all still perceptions of the world.
Yes. Okay. I see what you're saying now. The world is this giant horizon.
Yes.
I think he uses the word of possible of things or objects. And there are lots of different possible perceptions of those things and objects.
Wouldn't he have to deny that there are objects to be perceived themselves, that the very making of the objects is a function of our logos, is a function of our individual perceptions, the particular objects we make? That the distinction of this and that is a result of the way our perception works, and that might change from perceiver to perceiver.
I think that's one of the objections that can be raised, because I don't think he didn't get to that level of granularity in this particular essay that I recall. Yeah.
But I think you're right, though, Dylan. I mean, those sorts of distinctions, like the cognitive science distinctions between a bee's perception, right, which is going to be very different from a human being's perception, and the scientific perspective on cognition, I think he sees his position as compatible with all of that. I don't know how it ends up being compatible exactly.
Yeah. So he says, and I'm on page 93 of the Primacy, he says, the world itself is not an object in the sense that the mathematician or the physicist would give this word, but it is the universal style of all possible perceptions. And he says that this aligns with what Kant agrees with. He says, we can only think the world because we have already experienced it. It is through the experience that we have the idea of being, and it's through this experience that the words rational and real receive a sense. And then he goes on to talk about simple sensations, and he uses the example of looking at a landscape, standing side by side with somebody in a landscape, where he says, if I attempt to show my friend something which I see and which he does not see, we cannot account for the situation by saying that I see something in my own world, and that I attempt by sending verbal messages to give rise to an analogous perception of the world in my friend. There are not two numerically distinct worlds plus a mediating language. There's a kind of demand that what is seen by me be seen by him also. That's actually, I think, an interesting example, you know, where you're trying to point something out to somebody. What he's saying is that if you're in a situation where you're with somebody and you're trying to point out something that you are experiencing to them, you are experiencing that thing as actually being there, and you are experiencing the world in such a way that this other person could be having the same experience, could be having the same perception that you are, and you're trying to just basically communicate and make them aware. If you think about it at that level of what's happening in that situation where Wes and I are watching a football game and I make a point prior to the snap to point out to Wes what the safety is backing off the line of scrimmage. He may be looking at the quarterback, right? At that point in time, at the raw level of being in the world, of experience in the world, I'm assuming that Wes and I are looking at exactly the same football game, just that his attention may not be directed at the same place that my attention is directed, and I'm trying to get him to put his attention in a different place, which is to say, perceive the thing that I'm perceiving.
Can I give a more extreme example?
As on one condition, and you know what my one condition is.
What?
No Nazis?
No Nazis.
No, I was not going to invoke Nazis at all. No.
Wes and Dylan are watching the History Channel together.
No, I was going to say, trying to explain looking at a right triangle and having myself or any of the four of us looking at that right triangle and having a two-year-old look at that right triangle and trying to explain to that two-year-old or the dog or the flower the Pythagorean theorem. And so you would say that you're both looking at the same thing. One thing that'd be interesting in this context for me is to articulate the difference of how Merleau-Ponty would articulate the failure of communication between the two-year-old and the mathematician.
So wait. I don't think that's the same kind of example.
You don't?
No.
I think it's exactly the same kind of example.
I don't. Let me tell you why.
Please do.
So in the section that I just cited, right before that, he says, if you and I are talking about the same world and the communication is in principle between us because the world has become an ideal existence and is the same for all of us, just like the Pythagorean theorem. So there's perceptual experience, so to speak, and then he talks about ideal experience. And he mentions in another place where he's talking about the physical laws of nature. We don't experience physical laws of nature. They are this idealized description that is validated by our experience, so to speak, when we set up test conditions and whatever. But our experience of the world...
Would you say it structures our experience once we know about them?
He does not say that. I think what he says is that, not that it structures, but that it's descriptive of experience. And because he wants experience to be primary. So he says, well, experience comes first. The description of experience through universal laws comes second. I'm just saying that the landscape example and the example of mathematics or geometry are different examples for him. So I would be careful about talking about trying to explain the Pythagorean theorem versus maybe something much more perceptually immediate about the triangle itself. Like if you were trying to point out that this particular triangle we were both looking at had a right angle, then you might have to, actually, that's a pretty good example. Then do you have to explain the concept of what is a right angle, or do we experience, like, how do we get that experience of right angleness?
What does it mean to be a thing, I think, is the question we're asking. For Husserl and for the phenomenologist, there's also this element, yes, we have access to the same world. That's already there in phenomenology. What Merleau-Ponty is adding is he's changing this concept of synthesis. He's using this word style now, the universal style of all possible perceptions, instead of the ideal synthesis. So in looking at this landscape, it's not a thing in virtue of its intellectual role. It's a more practical, I think on page 94, that paragraph you were reading said the last sentence is important. The thing imposes itself not as true for every intellect, but as real for every subject who shares my situation. He's trying to replace the sort of intellectual access to the object with some other sort of access, which is more primal, let's say, and practical, I think. Then he talks about the body founding the unity.
Right. So the body founding the Pythagorean theorem, and why the Pythagorean theorem is something that we find a priori is somehow determined by the body. And I wasn't quite clear on what that means.
It's on 94. Just as my body is a system of all my holds on the world, founds the unity of the objects which I perceive, instead of the intellect, it's the body which is founding the unity of objects and our shared access to objects. And does that include the Pythagorean theorem? Is it the Pythagorean theorem just like the landscape? Is that what you're asking, Mark?
No, it's a different level. He makes it clear that in making perception privileged, he's not saying something like the only objects in our ontology should be the ones that are just in the obvious everyday world that we see and hear. He acknowledges social reality as being sort of a more complicated. He even says it's appropriate that man should think of God, I think is something he says in here. Even the concept of God, like, so he's definitely not one of those logical positivists that says anything that we can't reduce to some particular sensory account, then we can't talk about.
Right.
So yeah, the Pythagorean theorem is something that can be a legitimate object of thought. And somehow that's affected. The only way I could make sense of this was to compare him to William James talking about these things, to say that he's some sort of pragmatist, that for William James, even the most abstract, apparently a priori truths, the truths of logic, somehow are things that we've posited because they fit in with our experience somehow. And so for Merleau-Ponty, when he's talking about geometry, say, and maybe this is why the Pythagorean theorem in particular might be contingent upon our situation, is that once we move to non-Euclidean geometries, then we see that we are getting at an aspect of experience. The fact that it looks like we're standing on a flat surface and that planes are flat and that the things that underlie not only Euclidean geometry, but just the assumption that the world is flat and can be treated as a Euclidean plane. But once we can sort of take a different perspective, then we can arrive at some different conclusions. In other words, even logical truths we could eventually come to reject for one reason or another.
The Pythagorean theorem isn't like a logical truth because it depends on the parallel postulate. The parallel postulate, which says that parallel lines don't meet no matter how far you extend them, that intuitively feels right, but in an axiomatic system, you can still use the opposite as a postulate and have a nice, coherent little system. With his talk of non-Euclidean geometry, you basically alter one of your assumptions and then get a different result. So the Pythagorean theorem is not a logical truth in the same way that if A, then B, and A, then B is a logical truth.
Yeah, he sort of addresses that on page 95. I don't really want to go into it, but he talks about contradiction and how we describe the perceived world, we arrive at this contradiction, the immanence and transcendence, and you have what Wes just was talking about. And he said, well, I'm not talking here about the sterile non-contradiction of formal logic and the justified contradictions of transcendental logic. He says, let's just put that aside for a second, but it's okay for us to be in this position. But we're not satisfied with that description of the world. We just kind of have to, at this point, acknowledge it and then move to the discussion of what is the relation between intellectual consciousness and perceptual consciousness, which I hope or I think parallels to some extent reflected and unreflected.
So what is that relation?
So I'm still not completely clear on what it is to say that perception or the world as revealed by perception is paradoxical. Is it just that there are these different aspects that seem very different from each other, and so at first blush, there appear to be contradictions? I can make a sentence that is diametrically opposed to another sentence you make, right? The buffalo is very small. No, the buffalo is very big. Those are both true from a certain point of view, right? If I'm describing the size of it on my retina or something, yes, it's very small because it's across that field from me, but I know that it's in fact very big. So there you go. There's the easiest kind of, and that perception is just replete with that kind of seeming paradox. You know, in that case, it's extremely easily unraveled, but that seems to extend to all these different systems of description. So like science, and I think mathematics, these are, for Merleau-Ponty, these are sort of like maps that we've drawn of perception. They're always just going to pick out some aspect of the perceived world. It even could be one of these higher level aspects, right? Not just, again, the brute colors and shapes, but they're never going to be the whole thing. And we have to keep in mind that these are all just what science is doing and what the arts are doing and all this stuff are just maps or descriptions or something of this more fundamental experience.
Obviously, any particular scientific law, let's say, or scientific fact is only going to pick out a portion of experience. But in the same way, right now, sitting in my room, as I look around, I'm only perceiving a very portion of the world. My perception of the world is not total in a way that science isn't. What I got from it, Mark, was more that even when I say that I'm perceiving my Kindle sitting on my desk in front of me, the contradiction is that I can't really talk about the Kindle being on the desk in front of me without talking about me. But at the same time,
yeah,
I can't experience the Kindle in its quote-unquote totality, as Dylan was talking about, that there's all different kinds of perceptions that could be being had at this time, and my window to those perceptions is very, very narrow. I don't have the eyes of the eagle or the ears of a dog. It's like you acknowledge that there's more, there's a quote-unquote thing out there that you don't have access to, but at the same time, it may only mean something because you're accessing it.
But I think that thing that you're referring to that's out there, that is the world of perception, though, for him. Even though, as you say, my particular perception is only going to be focusing on this one little thing, the structure of perception is always foreground, background, so that the one side of the Kindle I'm looking at is going to imply not only the other sides of the Kindle, but the world of which the Kindle is a part, and all this multiplicity of other available perspectives, all this stuff. And again, it's not just that I have the sensation of the immediate thing and I infer the rest of it, that we actually experience this world in this indefinite sense.
But look at the top of page 93, though. This is where he describes this paradox of immanence and transcendence in perception. Immanence, because the perceived object would not be able to be foreign to the one who perceives. Transcendence, because it always involves a beyond of what is actually given.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you guys are both right. He talks, on the one hand, of the transcendence. On the other hand, Mark, you're saying it's more immediately there in perception.
The difference between the scientific fact or the law of physics or what have you and my experience of the Kindle is that there's no truth value in my perception. We can speak of a scientific fact and we can say it's true or false Or we can say that such and such a thing is possible, like there's a particle that's heavier or faster or whatever the hell the terms are they use in physics, you know, than this smallest thing that we found. We might find the smaller one. But in our experience, we don't assign truth values. We just simply experience the world, like you say, near, far, in its totality, what have you. And that's kind of one of the key distinctions, from what I can tell, between perceived consciousness and intellectual consciousness. And that's why science is part of intellectual consciousness.
I hadn't thought about it that way, but would that make truth value, or the assignation of truth value, you called intellectual consciousness?
I'm using his words.
Yeah. So that would be essentially truth value is a product of judgment. Is that right?
Yep.
Well, the concept of truth itself is something that I'm imposing some kind of pragmatism on him.
Yes. I'm very sympathetic to that. It sounds very in line with that way of understanding science, at least to the extent that pragmatism is, especially along the purse end, is articulating a way of understanding the scientific process and project without focusing on the particular laws, in fact, allowing room for constant revision. It seems to me that Merleau-Ponty is right in there, but maybe criticizing a certain dogmatism in science, or at least in scientific institutions.
He's definitely doing that. If you look on page 96, he says, "Should we now generalize and say that what is true of perception is also true in the order of the intellect, and that in a general way, all our experience, all our knowledge has the same fundamental structure? In other words, should we talk about scientific knowledge in the same way that we talk about perceptual experience?" And he says, "No doubt some would oppose the absolute truth or evidence of scientific knowledge to this, but it seems to me the acquisitions of the philosophy of sciences confirm the primacy of perception." And he goes on to talk about Braunschweig. He mentions him a lot in this essay. But he talks about how scientific knowledge cannot be closed in on itself, you know, that it always consists in clarifying a pre-scientific world, the analysis of which will never be finished.
Yeah, and then you get this talk of the illusion of the law in positivism, the illusion of the law is truer than the fact, right?
Mm-hmm.
Going at it from the semi-pragmatist interpretation, he would acknowledge that it was a perspective. There would be some separate discussion we'd have about this process of judging truth, what that criteria is. And my guess is that in talking about science, there would be a big, long discussion about the way in which it's validated by successive perceivers. And there's criteria that is established such that things that are held to be true are simultaneously agreed upon by a large number of them, and he would see no problem with that. But at the end, like a pragmatic interpretation of science, he allows for the room for you to completely renovate the way you thought about it, because you never hold the previous law to be utterly dogmatic. You understand the law, and you understand Newton's law, for instance, and work on that, but you always understand that the world is out there, pregnant with possibility and to be understood more. And that's the way in which you can say, well, Newton's law is true, but Einstein's law is true too. And maybe you have a criteria for a hierarchy amongst them and stuff like that, but you never get in a knockdown, drag out fight about that, right?
Yeah. And I think you would agree with all of that. But I think he's privileging, you know, he says, for instance, in the same passage, the perceived event can never be absorbed into the complex of transparent relations which the intellect constructs because of the event. He's talking about the intellect constructing these laws. And then the laws themselves are relational, right? And then there's this non-relational foundation on which these relations are based. So at the more primal level of perception, I think there are just particulars.
I don't know if I want to say particulars.
Okay.
I don't want to use that language now.
Well, this particular as opposed to law. I'm trying to get at what he's doing here with this concept of law.
Yeah, right in that same place, Wes. He says, Braunschweig reproached positivism for its dogmatic illusion that the law is truer than the fact.
Right.
The law, he adds, is conceived exclusively to make the fact intelligible. So, Dylan, it's a very scientific approach, I think, where you say, like, well, no, there's no such thing as a scientific law. They're just more or less well-proven hypotheses. And if we have a hypothesis that makes sense or makes intelligible some set of experiences or some events in the world or something along the lines, and we continue to validate that with each of the next successive event of the same type, then we say, okay, that's a good law or a good theory. And if we find an event that seems to contradict it, then we have to go back to the drawing board. And he uses this example of Pythagoras, the Pythagorean theorem. At one point, that was considered as true, and not just true for this moment only, but true in itself. And then we discover non-Euclidean geometries, and it doesn't annul the Pythagorean theorem. It just points out that it has a partial application to the world where we might have thought that it had a much broader application.
Going back to this notion of theory ladenness, I mean, something like the Pythagorean theorem seems to me to be a little bit easier of a case than as you get more and more sophisticated in scientific accounts and you have your, I don't know if particulars is the right word, but you have your perceptions become folded onto each other. So they're really, they're perceptions of perceptions. So when you look at, you extrapolate that there are electron tracks in a particle physics experiment, you're really gathering together a whole bunch of extrapolations that you've made, and they're perfectly good extrapolations, but you have rendered objects that have relations that then you analyze and extrapolate based on those relations and ask questions about them. It seems to me that there's a distinction to be made in that kind of perception versus the buffalo being far away. Maybe there isn't, but the direct sense data as opposed to the heightened sense data through instruments, is that going to make a difference for Merleau-Ponty?
Like if you're looking through a microscope.
Microscope isn't going to be good enough. If you look at figures from a particle physics collision, they're going to be tracks, lines that you've drawn on a computer screen or on a piece of paper that represent signals that occurred in pieces of equipment that you use an algorithm to join those signals together. And you draw those tracks, and then you have those tracks and cross one another. And then you talk about the interaction that had happened and where the electron was. You've used that particle physics experiment as a microscope, but not an optical microscope, a kind of intellectual microscope.
Mm-hmm.
The perceptions are sort of perceptions of perceptions in a funny way, right? You've already objectified them, and then you are analyzing the relations of those objects. And that goes to this whole notion of theory ladenness. And I'm wondering if there is a distinction to be made that Merleau-Ponty would need to deal with or not.
That's a good point. I mean, you're still talking about an event, right?
Yeah, in the world. An event. That's exactly how a physicist would talk about it. So this is an event.
You're talking about an event that I otherwise would not, I wouldn't perceive with my body unless I had this equipment.
That's right.
The event really, in the Merleau-Ponty sense, the event here is whatever you're looking at on the computer screen or in the cloud chamber or however that works, right?
That's right.
Yeah. As long as you're still talking about an event and not talking about some sort of,
I mean, what perception here is perception is of the, I think in Dylan's case, you're describing something you would see on a computer screen, right?
Sure.
And then the talk of electrons is already at the level of the intellectual, of coming up with a model or a theory of things that have been perceived.
But then ramming them into each other and having that represented on a computer screen becomes a perception. The electron itself is part of it's not part of...
But in some other practical circumstance, this would just be a video game for me. This could be asteroids, let's say.
No. I think Dylan's onto something interesting here. At some point, atoms were concepts. Somebody hypothesized that such a thing existed as a way of trying to explain something else.
Yeah, a model.
In other words, it was this thing that was conceived to make the facts intelligible. And then somebody figured out a way to try to prove the existence of one and quote unquote see an electron. And then it itself became one of the facts.
No, I think an atom is still a model, right? It's a theoretical construct. And the appearances you're describing, for instance, include, say, spectra from certain experiments. You're doing experiments and you're producing direct experiences, but you're not. Dylan's a physicist here, so clear this up.
I wanted to follow Seth down the road and say that what Seth described would also be true of the two views of the buffalo. And that the experiment I do in the end is I walk towards the buffalo, always keeping my eye on the buffalo and have it grow in my perspective and become bigger. And it's not until I do that, that I've really confirmed that the buffalo that I see as a little tiny thing back there and the one is actually a buffalo.
This sounds like an objection, though, to Merleau-Ponty.
I don't know if it's an objection. I'm just kind of curious, like, is it possible for something that we cannot perceive to be used to explain the perceptible, and then we develop the ability to perceive the thing, like bacteria.
I see.
Yeah.
So until we had microscopes, we didn't see bacteria, and then we did. We hypothesized it, and then you saw them. Now you can see them. I don't know. Are those two different things?
I don't think anyone hypothesized those, though, actually. They were discovered.
This is part of that, those higher levels of experience that he's talking about, that experience is not just of colors and shapes, but that we experience these, what we might analyze as theoretical entities, and we experience them sort of immediately, that they're part of the perspective.
Yes, that's what's going on in particle physics experiment for sure.
But Merleau-Ponty doesn't want to say that every object is an object of perception. There are such things as intellectual objects. Pythagorean theorem, for instance, that for Merleau-Ponty seems to be something that's not simply perceptual, it's intellectual. We have to say that some things are intellectual, and he seems to talk about science as an intellectual endeavor with intellectual objects. I think perception is something much more primal for Merleau-Ponty.
My thought is that he wants to say that that distinction is not as radical as has been said in the past, that he wants to blur the distinction between the activity we have on intellectual objects and the activity we have of perception.
We should note, though, that what scientists are often doing is that takes intellectual work. It's not the same intuitively obvious thing that's going on in perception. I think we need some sort of distinction, because Merleau-Ponty seems to be making it, between the intellectual and the perceptual.
Just to add to that, when we get to the quantum level, it seems like if we imagined that we were directly perceiving the thing, like we can't even make sense of what's going on.
Yeah.
Well, but isn't he going to have to say that when he says perception is nascent logos, I want to interpret him as saying that the distinction between that higher level perception, intellectual perception, and the more primal perception is a distinction of degree, not of kind. That there's nothing super added going on, nothing super added in our consciousness. There's no added faculty. It's just a further development on the same sort of thing. It's the same exact sort of activity that's going on. It's just more and more refined.
It's hard to reconcile that with his talk of when we perceive something, there is a presence. It's not a question of affirming or denying a proposition, but there's just a presence. You know, truth and falsity do not apply to. Truth and falsity come later. Whereas when you're talking about these intellectual terms, I mean, aren't you making a claim about the theoretical entities involved that could be true or false? I mean, it seems like it's a different thing.
Yeah, I don't know how you draw the line or whether you say, yes, it's on a continuum or a matter of degree, but it seems important that we make this distinction between the product of the intellectual and the scientific and what I think he thinks is going on at a very primal and immediate level.
One point I wanted to follow up on here to see what you made of it. So intellection depends to some extent on our phenomenological standpoint, on our experience. It's certainly not unique to Merleau-Ponty. But just to give an example, and I think this is especially relevant for moral philosophy. So I was trying to give a roughly phenomenological analysis of Adam Smith. And even to the extent, and I was carrying this through the discussion of the Euthyphro as well, where it seems like, speaking as a good phenomenologist, I think that anybody who's thinking clearly can analyze our experience and see that we have something like these moral sentiments, maybe not the exact ones that Adam Smith is describing. Then if we think far enough, what is suggested to me is that we would go closer to this ideal where we would actually come up with consistent moral rules. And none of that is dependent on there being moral rules apart from human beings or something. This is just a phenomenological matter of experience. And I was going so far as to compare Adam Smith and Plato in that respect, because Plato also thinks that if you engage in this process of critical reflection, you'll eventually, in effect, be able to see outside the cave to get some glimpse of the forms. There is light at the end of the tunnel. And it seems like Merleau-Ponty is giving a version of phenomenology that is maybe against that kind of idealist, not in the sense of everything is an idea, but in the sense of that there's an ultimate destination that we would all, as like-minded observers, get to. Right, because he wants to say that we can't privilege the rational people living in our culture and say that's the key to getting at truth. I mean, that's one possible route by which we could come up with a standard we could agree on, but that's different from truth in some larger sense. And so he wants to say that animals and the uncivilized and the insane and children, we can't just say that they have sort of corrupted versions of our sentiments. We have to say that they have their own different way of perceiving and therefore, I guess, getting at truth, if truth even enters the picture, right?
They're perceiving the same world as we are, importantly.
Yes. He has a slight discussion of ethics, I guess, in one of his responses to his questioners. The questioner is asking if he believes that humans have an absolute value.
Do you remember which of the questioners it was? Breyer.
Lupasco.
Lemoine.
Which one is acting
Bauer.
About ethics?
It's page 111.
Yeah, so here's the quote on 111. Breyer asked me just now, do you posit the other as an absolute value? I answered, yes, insofar as a human can do so. And he says something very pragmatist sounding. But when I was in the army, I had to call for an artillery barrage or an air attack. And at that moment, I was not recognizing an absolute value in the enemy soldiers who were the object of these attacks. I can, in such a case, promise to hold generous feelings toward the enemy. I cannot promise not to harm him. So that is to say, even our most fundamental ethical truths are sort of dependent on the circumstance. And maybe there's something common in the way human beings are such that we could found an ethics on this persistent appearance, you might say. But we can't say that there's something absolute about it. And in fact, if some other kind of creature has a different way of apprehending the world, then they're going to come to a different conclusion. And in a significant sense, their conclusion is just as valid as mine. So there's a strong sense of relativism here.
What I don't like about calling it relativism is that I guess it presumes that morality isn't about judging, that somehow morality exists in the world. And maybe that's the whole point of the argument, is saying, well, yeah, morality exists in the world in the same way that perceptions exist in the world, as opposed to being judgments about the world.
Didn't we come to that conclusion when we were talking about Sartre?
That morality exists in the world, or that morality is a judgment about the world?
That it exists in the world. There is simply Peter having to be helped.
Yep.
And the pragmatist, I think, would go in the same direction.
And we can analyze that and pick apart the subject and the object and say, oh, I'm only thinking that because I'm in love with Peter, or I hate Peter or something. And we can then change our intellection of the thing and say, oh, Peter actually is okay. That, you know, doesn't need to be helped.
I just want to be extraordinarily naive here. I took a class when I was an undergraduate, my freshman year, by a philosopher, and he had this book that was called What is Moral? I think I got rid of that book. And what I want to hear is, what does it mean to say something is moral or not? Is it the case that I mean my feeling that someone needs to be helped is a moral judgment? Because that doesn't strike me necessarily as the way I think of a moral judgment. For pseudo-professional philosophers, what does it mean to say that that's moral?
Yeah, you know, it does seem like morality is going to be, for Merleau-Ponty, one of those creatures of abstraction, like a branch of science. You might have value judgments right there in experience, but to distinguish a moral judgment from another kind of value judgment, I'm not sure that that's going to be right there in experience. I'm not sure about that, because Hume seemed to think that we had these just distinct feeling sentiments. You know, if I disapprove of somebody because they're dressed in a way that I think is gross, then I have a different sort of sentiment than if they're acting in a way that I think is coarse and immoral.
I guess I wouldn't dispute that those are perceptions. And I guess I would also suspect that those are higher level perceptions along the lines of even scientific perceptions that I have that are filtered through other intellectual exercises. When I look at a collision and I say, oh, look at how much momentum that carried. That linebacker carries a lot of momentum. That is a several orders of perception, right? At the very least. Even if we wanted to call that a perception, which that was part of our discussion a few minutes ago. Your example from Hume seems to me of that kind of order. It's just filled up with other things that we bring to the table. Not to say that it isn't functioning as a perception, but that it's includes, for lack of a better term, you know, theory, but also judgments that you've made. I'm not saying that to criticize it. I'm just trying to understand this notion of, I guess I would think of it as moral fact. Because there's a way in which my knee-jerk reaction is to say that there simply aren't moral facts. In the same way that there are other kinds of measurement facts, that there's something about it that's not measured in the same way, that it relies on things that we can't all agree on exactly.
Sure, I think you could even be a moral realist and think that still the moral facts present themselves in some very different way, such that you can't measure them and have the same sort of intersubjective agreement. I mean, that seems almost an epistemological issue rather than a metaphysical issue. Again, that's a little foreign to Merleau-Ponty's terminology.
No, I'm not trying to take us off the beaten path. I just wanted, to the extent that we would venture into morality and thinking about the way in which madmen make normative judgments and the difference between the way children look at the world, and have a, then jump into this discussion of morality and sentiment, I've just never understood exactly the term moral. So it is outside of the discussion.
It's a legitimate question to bring up.
Yeah.
Because I'm even looking at his Phenomenology of Perception, there aren't chapters on society and the moral, and yet he says in this Primacy of Perception article that, yeah, really to fill it out, I should add that kind of stuff too. It's like he really wanted to be just like Hegel's Phenomenology that covers fucking everything. And, oh no, I only, yeah, in my 500 some pages, I didn't quite get to the social aspects, you know, even though he talks about like the body as a sexual being and some other things that kind of approach that. What did you make of this whole emphasis on animals and little children and uncivilized people? What do we get out of that?
All of them being equal, right?
My favorite lecture.
Yes, it was. It was by far the most interesting.
Just the juxtaposition of children and animals and primitive peoples.
He didn't have a reference to the American Indian savages, did he? That I missed.
Right, that was Adam Smith's example. And he also, as the...
Him and everybody else. Locke.
Rousseau, yeah.
Whoever wrote the introduction to this pointed out that he could have just as easily brought in women here and made some feminist point. Not to say that they're like the uncivilized or children, but that they could have a different and legitimate sort of take on experience that's particular to gender or something. But he didn't have that in mind. However, we could read Simone de Beauvoir, who would definitely say exactly that.
You know, the basic argument seems to be, through the whole thing, the world of perception, that's what it's called, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's an argument about the feasibility, about saying our knowledge is always subject to revisability. And when he brings up animals and children, he's talking about the extent to which we still have those aspects of in ourselves. And in our fantasies, dreams, patterns of magical behavior remain all powerful in shaping our private and public life and our relationships with other people. There he's talking about Freud. And then he says, these leave his knowledge of the natural world riddled with gaps, which is how poetry creeps in. So he's critiquing this idea of the absolute objective spectator. I think that's part of it.
Mm-hmm. So in some ways, this whole thing is just another version of that general, not anti-science argument, but trying to put science in perspective. That if you think science is going to yield all of what is available to human knowledge, then you don't understand science. That what science is an abstraction from some particular aspect of perception and sort of codifying that. And so, yeah, it's only going to say as much as was in the part that you're abstracting from. And if you, by your scientific method, for instance, rule out all first-person judgments, try to give a theory of consciousness based on that, then you're going to miss a lot of essential stuff. So it's kind of echoing some of the same points that Nagel and some of the other people made.
Yeah, although I think you've put it in a way that's stronger than Merleau-Ponty. I mean, the way he puts it in these essays, and I was disappointed with The World of Perception, just because it's these basic ideas about, yes, we should be defeasibleists, we should recognize that scientific knowledge is subject to revision. Well, that's a kind of truism, and I saw a lot of sort of, these are radio lectures, granted, but a lot of these sorts of truisms in these essays. You know, the more nuanced position, I mean, scientism is not a critique of science per se, it's a critique of the idea that all interesting questions are susceptible to scientific inquiry, or any question that's not susceptible to empirical scientific inquiry is meaningless, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really even a critique of scientism here. It's just spouting general truisms about science isn't, well, I guess it is, you know, scientific knowledge isn't the only sort of knowledge. But really, he's talking about the feasibility, the idea that our knowledge is always indefinite, be subject to revision, which science already incorporates that idea, right? Science is full of hypotheses, which are subject to revision. We understand that, for instance, so recently, there's this experiment suggesting that neutrinos are a little bit faster than the speed of light. Maybe those experiments are flawed. Maybe they're not. There's always the possibility that Einstein's theory of special relativity will be modified or refined.
And in fact, importantly, from a scientific perspective, there'd be a kind of glee at that being true.
Yeah, exactly.
And the kind of trope that you hear about scientists, particle physicists at least, talking about the standard model and stuff, is they're just pining for something to turn out that they measure to be completely different and at odds with what they've been predicting all along, which hasn't been true in, you know, 40 years or something like that. There was a heyday in the 40s and 50s where nobody knew what the hell was going on. And there's a kind of pining for that time, because now you have way more theories and accounts than you have experimental evidence that contradicts anything.
Yeah.
Isn't there also, though, besides just the feasibility, the idea that art could be a legitimate source of knowledge that science can't get a hold of? And yeah. Right, in the same way. So what the baby or the insane person's perspective is, could somehow reveal, I don't know if you want to say legitimate knowledge, but what it is doing is not just a degraded form of what you are doing in your scientific investigation. And so, like you were saying, Wes, if those things are all still even reflected in us, many of them in our dreams and other ways of experiencing things, then we could use art, for instance, to tap into some of these things and get at some important something, I guess he would call knowledge. It's an aspect of perception.
See, the thing is, if you look at his analysis of Cézanne, and you get this very general idea of, okay, Cézanne is recapturing the feeling of experience itself because he's forcing us to attend to objects through time. He's disrupting our sense that we are these sort of absolute observers of objects that are simultaneously there in time. And then space is no longer a medium for simultaneous objects with an absolute observer or a disembodied subject. And then maybe it's because I'm just so used to hearing it. It sounds trite, it sounds cliched, or it doesn't strike me as a very advanced or substantive kind of knowledge. These sorts of generalizations, you know, I wasn't impressed with the world of perception thing. What did you guys think of all that?
I guess the question is our dissatisfaction with this a matter of that when you translate these difficult-to-read ideas that are in Merleau-Ponty's other works into everyday language, then you can just see how trite and... Yeah. In other words, this is exposing the shittiness of his full philosophy, or is it really just because the real work of his philosophy is in the deep-down, detailed phenomenological analysis that he's going to do in his other work, and he just can't give it here, and so he's not trying?
That's exactly the question I had.
I guess I feel like I want to give him another chance. This was somebody I was really looking forward to reading. This was even somebody that I used for part of my master's thesis along with William James and Husserl. So I read his chapter on attention in the phenomenology of perception and remembering thinking that it was very insightful. With all these guys, I kind of feel like Husserl was unsatisfying because he never got beyond talking about fucking method. He never got to actually talking about the contents of experience. And, Sartre is unsatisfying because he's so freaking manic about the concept of freedom that it kind of warps his view of everything else and makes him look at consciousness as this absolute free spontaneity, whereas Merleau-Ponty is more grounded and wants to not talk about consciousness in the abstract, but about this embodied thing. And Heidegger is messed up for all these other reasons and his horrible language and that he even abandoned the phenomenological project. So, Merleau-Ponty, maybe that's the guy who really has the whole package and gets it right. So he's just stood there as like a symbol of the promise of phenomenology. And I never, even in writing my master's, dove enough into reading him to say whether that's true. And this experience has not given me any greater insight into that.
It's so funny you say that, because earlier Dylan had asked me like what it would look like if somebody was to get the body involved and extend Heidegger's analytic of Dasein to the body. And I had the exact same thing. Like Merleau-Ponty represented this promise of completing like Heidegger. Even Heidegger gave it up. What the hell am I looking for? Right? Like, I'm looking for somebody to complete being in time. And even Heidegger gave it up. It's just funny. I totally get what you're saying, though. Yeah. Everybody points to Merleau-Ponty as this sort of synthesis of all these great thinkers. And I mean, maybe he's just oversold in the canon.
And to me, it's very, and again, maybe we would have a different opinion if we looked at phenomenology perception, but it's aspirational. These sort of slogans about the body subject and the importance of the body. Well, that's an interesting idea, but it's not explained to me. I don't come away knowing what the body subject means or how he's returned us to the body here.
Can we look for some examples that he gives in here?
Okay. I guess it's sort of an example. He anticipates a criticism, which I guess is the end of the, I want to call it the serious essay.
The primacy of perception.
The primacy of perception.
Presentation. Yeah.
It's either in the essay itself or it's one of the early responses where he anticipates the criticism that Well, look, I agree with you all the way. You've presented a phenomenology of psychology, and your account of the way in which people work is fine. But that really doesn't get to the question that we're all actually concerned about, which is what bearing that has on the way the world actually is. And then another criticism, which would be that the emphasis on the body nature of perspective at best diverts and at worst subverts the notion that you actually would have genuine knowledge about the world and overemphasizes the multiplicative possibility of perception as giving information about the world. Yes, dogs do see the same world I do, and dogs do have a perception of the world, but it's not nearly as full and robust and truthful as the scientific perspective or some other perspective. And he anticipates that criticism a little bit. That's sort of the kind of elephant in the room, I suppose, that is always begged by this kind of perspectivalism, is the willingness to say, look, yes, of course, the madman has a perspective and he is seeing things that are similar to me, but what he's seeing is just not true.
Yeah.
And Merleau-Ponty emphasizes the phenomenology of that perspective, but the criticism would be, I don't disagree with you. But you seem to be dodging the point, which is, what do we actually know?
Yeah, how do we account for error? You know, it's there in the Theaetetus. These theories are great until you try and account for error and illusion, and then it becomes a mess.
Wouldn't there be a couple different kinds of error, right? I mean, if we go back to the Pythagorean example, there would be one error about you would either not prove the Pythagorean theorem correctly, so you would make an error along those lines. You would not see or understand, comprehend the Pythagorean theorem. That would be another kind of problem, another kind of error. And then there would be errors about illusion or hallucination, where it seems like you could get around that by saying, well, yes, this person is perceiving that. And then you're going to have to rely at the end of the day on the fact that a kind of multiplicity of perception. You're going to have to rely on a kind of corroboration. That truth about whether or not there's a ghost or something has a lot to do with corroboration in a very basic experimental science kind of way. Modern science would say it that way, but even before then, if a lot of people didn't see it, then it wasn't true, right?
Yeah, so he talks about hierarchies at some point. There are all these different perspectives. Are they hierarchical? And it seems like his answer was, yes, depending on your point of view. You can just interpret this pragmatically. So if we're engaged in the sort of enterprise where we're trying to figure out scientific truth, then yeah, there's a clear hierarchy and we can say the man is in error. But if we're doing something else, then we could have a different hierarchy. That the hierarchy itself. So I'm really, what's filling in the gap here, if folks want to go back and listen to our Nelson Goodman episode, we gave a very involved notion of conceptual schemes and how these could be applied in hierarchies and how these could be applied to different sort of situations. And like Merleau-Ponty, Nelson Goodman was keenly interested in how to apply these not only to, you know, accounts of science and causality and things like that, but to judgment of artworks. So again, I'm seeing Merleau-Ponty as a cheerleader for a general class of positions rather than as really elaborating what he himself, what's unique about his own philosophy. He did give one example specific to why the body affects perception. He talked about how vertical distances, because it's more important for us to see things on the ground than in the sky, then we have a better assessment of how far away something is or something if it's on the vertical plane than if it's high up.
It's his phenomenological account of the illusion of the size of the harvest moon, and that you look at it and you see this gigantic moon on the horizon, and that's just an illusion. It's not any bigger or any smaller than it is when it's way up in the sky and looks smaller than the size of your thumb.
So that's supposed to say something about how perspective is affected by the fact that we are bodily creatures of the type that we are, with the needs that we have, which when I say it that way, it seems kind of uncontroversial. But
is part of his problem the same problem that pragmatists have, in that there's a seed of it that's sort of uncontroversial or seemingly uncontroversial about the process of revision and interacting with the world, but it doesn't address the thing that's most near and dear to other philosophers' heart, which is adjudicating whether something is true about the world or not?
Yeah.
So they end up getting criticized as being relativists. because they admit a perspectivalism and stuff like that. They constantly deny that because they admit of revision and things are better and worse and stuff like that. But because they don't buy into the notion of absolute truth, then they just get vilified for their perspectivalism. And the problem becomes something like, how can it be perspectival without it being something like approaching the actual truth of the matter? Because they also want to deny the successive series aspect of it without denying that it's partially true, right?
The successive series aspect of it. What do you mean by that?
Yes, explain yourself.
If it's a successive series, it would be that every perspective adds up more and more. And at the core of it, even asymptotically, you're approaching the one true thing. And I think Merleau-Ponty explicitly wants to deny that, that the kind of infinite that he's talking about is not one of the asymptotic approach to the one true thing, or maybe Kant's the thing in itself that we all have reflections of, or Plato's the object that reflects in the good and you see a reflection of a reflection of an image of it. It seems to me that the pragmatists and Merleau-Ponty sort of deny that account. They want to say that the world is out there. There is one world, period, end stop. And you can know more about it, but it's not a process towards a absolute truth about it. That seems to be, to me, at least where the big argument comes from, right?
Yeah, I think for me, pragmatism, I still struggle with how to avoid relativism or idealism. I think those are the two things that it can degenerate into. Yeah, it's still unclear to me. You know, pragmatism is appealing to me, but the problem of error, again, that classical problem always rears its ugly head.
Yeah, and am I right that in the notion that you would agree all along the way about sort of the phenomenological articulation of the way in which we process that knowledge, but sort of the end game is the problem?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a good way to put it.
Can we say maybe that at least how Merleau-Ponty sees himself as innovating as opposed to William James or something, is the first line of the Primacy of Perception article is, "The unprejudiced study of perception by psychologists has finally revealed that the perceived world is not a sum of objects, in the sense in which the sciences use this word, that our relationship to the world is not that of a thinker to an object of thought, and finally, that the unity of the perceived thing as perceived by several consciousnesses is not comparable to the unity of a proposition as understood by several thinkers, any more than the perceived existence is comparable to ideal existence." And so just the fact that he thinks it's not just that I'm backing off, like Husserl says, and doing phenomenological examination, which Descartes even could have done and started doing, but that these gestalt psychologists, which are the ones he's most excited about, have found that we don't, contra to the empiricists, perceive things atomistically.
Mm.
That we perceive whole sets of things at a time. Perception is of a whole figure, not of individual elements that then we intellectually combine into a figure. And I guess the common example of this that's given now is the duck-rabbit example. So you could draw the little picture that it could look like a duck from this perspective and it could like a rabbit from this perspective, but you can't make yourself see both at the same time. This just shows that in our experience, we sort of are delivered the end result and don't piece things together. Mm. And then he goes on to say, well, why isn't this then just a piece of gestalt psychology that's particular to presupposing a general subject-object distinction? And psychology is one of the things that studies the object that is man or something. And then he gives the whole Kantian Husserlian background of why this figure ground thing is important, why we should adopt a phenomenological stance. So it seems like he's trying to combine these two things. Right, so there's nothing new about be a phenomenologist, because right. You know Husserl, who is his teacher's teacher, said that. But yet, the fact that this isn't just a bunch of crazy phenomenologists saying this stuff, it's that mainstream psychology of his time has acknowledged what is perhaps the key finding here, which is this non-atomic view of perception. And that is supposed to lead to all the rest of this. Once you admit that we grasp macroscopic figures instead of just individual elements, well, hell, let's open to ourselves to the sort of analyses that Sartre was talking about. And, you know, I perceive Pierre as needing to be helped, and I perceive this as hateful, and I perceive the things in the atomic chamber through the computer screen and all this other sort of what we might consider derivative forms of perception, that this is in fact not adding something. This is just an essential part of what perception is. Did that sound unique, or this is still just more platitudes?
Isn't part of what's lurking behind this a question of what is the ontology or metaphysics of this situation. Mm-hmm. Like, what claim about being and the way the world is lurking behind this? Because if I follow up the problem of what the end game is, yes, you've articulated what the experience of the world is like and the way we process it is like. What I really want to know is what the world is and what things are and what kinds of beings there are in it. So when I say that, I'm revealing that at the end of the day, I really do believe in metaphysics at some level. And either you are denying metaphysics at all, or you're qualifying metaphysics in some way, you pragmatist, you Merleau-Ponty. And if you are not denying it, then what kinds of beings are you talking about? What are these things that exist in the world? And if they're not things, what kind of entities are they? What beings are they? And I want you to talk about those, because I'm tired of hearing about perspective. Damn it.
Well put.
All I could do is like fill in the gaps from Nelson Goodman and say, just to annoy you, that the ontology is going to be just a sort of a pragmatic function of what you're trying to do at the time.
But even if it's pragmatic, I'm cool with it being pragmatic. But I want to hear what the conclusions are, right?
Right.
The pragmatic account of science is to say it's pragmatic, but also say, well, science is talking about atoms or particles or fields or elementary particles or strings or whatever the hell it is. I want to hear that talk about being.
Yeah. How about embodied subjects?
Which is to say, you can be a methodological or epistemological pragmatist and say, yes, this is the way people go about acquiring knowledge. But what makes it knowledge versus illusion?
Yeah. What is the thing that you say you're knowing?
Yeah.
What's that piece?
What is the world really like at bottom that grounds all that?
Yes. I grant that it's all provisional. I grant that I might change my mind tomorrow, yada, 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 just like I might throw out general relativity tomorrow. But I want to know what the corresponding picture of being that you have is that corresponds to the picture of the world in general relativity as a giant rubber sheet, right? That's the thing that pisses me off about people like Merleau-Ponty. They sit there and they wallow in, ooh, infinite perspectives, yeah, 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 big fucking deal, right?
Profanity, more profanity, yes. This is why we have explicit on our
podcast. If you can't get passionate about metaphysics, Wes, what can you get passionate about?
Didn't Mark describe the podcast as shooting the shit after seminar over a couple of beers?
Yes, no, this is only praise.
That's how we started out.
You're being praised, not censored.
Yes, so any after seminar discussion I've ever been in descends into profanity at some point.
That is true. So.
But that's when it's the most interesting.
I agree.
Look, as far as I can tell from these readings, that he's concerned with protecting humanism in the face of materialistic science.
No, I know, but you know what? I'm tired of that shit. I really am.
You don't think he's given it any kind of metaphysical grounding here by saying...
I want to hear the metaphysical grounding.
Well, part of it is just a negative.
Yes,
to if you are a materialist, if you're a naturalist, then you have a certain ontology. And I'm saying that that ontology is an abstraction from perception and it falsifies, in fact, perception.
I don't know if he says it falsifies. I think he's just saying it's at a different level of abstraction, that there's a part that's before that, before science. You abstract from something that's more basic and more immediate. I think at least he thinks he's not trying to do something that's inconsistent with science. And it's not merely a scientism critique, which I'm very sympathetic to. He's talking more here about this sort of knowledge that comes before scientific knowledge.
Isn't he trying to make science less scary by putting it in perspective? Isn't he trying to make it less scary to those who would be saying, oh, science is trying to deny we have souls and deny our freedom and all this kind of stuff and say we're just cogs in a machine. And he's saying, look, you can accept determinism is fine.
Yeah.
All these things that science, you know, that psychology are going to say, Freud, all that stuff is actually fine, because once you put it in perspective, you can see that still we have a legitimate viewpoint of ourselves as, well, not completely free beings in the way that Sartre describes this spastic, absolutely unrooted point of consciousness, but that whatever the still free but embodied version of that is.
Yeah. And also because the phenomenological perspective and the embodied perspective is prior to all that, right? The scientist is an embodied, fallible human being, not some absolute observer.
And maybe if we weren't all jaded and hadn't heard all this crap in slightly different versions from a number of other thinkers.
Yeah, maybe it would seem more original.
Then we would find this revolutionary and wonderful. And so listeners to the radio in 1948 would be like, whoa, man, it's fucking crazy.
I'm sympathetic to the criticisms of scientism, criticisms of the idea that the empirical sciences are the right method for every interesting question. I think there are questions which are properly philosophical, which are not susceptible to science. But what I at least see in these radio lectures is sort of, I think of it as aspirational or almost the kind of thing you could put on a
Hallmark card?
Yeah, or a protest sign or something. It's just, yes, like man, the body and body and mind are one, dude. It's aspirational in the sense that, yes, we'd like to show that. That's the goal, but let's not ignore all the problems, right? We want to say why and how and explain things. Just to say, dude, stop being a dualist and blah, blah, blah. That bothers me. Because people aren't dualists just for the fuck of it. They're motivated. And so you got to address the things that are motivating them and say, no, you're wrong about this, and say exactly why. And I say this because I read a lot of psychoanalysis stuff. It's very steeped in the continental literature, and there's a lot of homilies and slogans about stop making a distinction between mind and body. Mind is body. And that's great. But people didn't start making that distinction, you know, again, for the fuck of it. It reflects a certain problem, and I want to see that problem seriously addressed. And I'm not saying Merleau-Ponty doesn't address that seriously somewhere. I'm just saying in these lectures, I didn't get that, and I felt bothered by it.
I was just going to ask if Dylan could think of any examples of anybody who falls into this camp who at least tries to give a metaphysical account.
I can't. You have these constructivists who want to allow for the revisionism of science, ontological structuralists who want to have science be a kind of experimental metaphysics, which I'm very sympathetic with, that we learn more about what the things that are and how they are and what they are as we look at them. But you know, I haven't read a lot of them and certainly haven't found any of them that strike me as having the big idea. The thing that makes me most interested along these lines is the way in which you would articulate a kind of metaphysics of emergence, where you have beings that allow for the generation and transformation of new beings that you would call genuine entities, rather than having a world in which you start with entities that then interact with one another, and in which all those subsequent entities are somehow merely derivative. I think that that's essentially a kind of Newtonian, deterministic kind of world. I think to get out of that, to have something that reflects more like what we see in evolution and what we see in quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, you're going to have something in which the entities are local and you're able to speak of what kind of things those are that are local, that is in time and place, that in interacting with one another give rise to genuinely new things, genuinely new beings. They transform in a way such that the result is not something that is a kind of mere addition. It's something genuinely new and different than what was before, and that you can articulate what you mean by being in both those cases. And that's what I see roughly something like emergence pointing towards. That's the sort of task that you have, is to talk about beings that have within them activity. That's why I talk about activity all the time, that they have activity in them that in their interactions with one another give rise to genuinely new beings, new entities, and that your account of being is going to have to include and articulate that.
It's clearly time to go back to the pre-Socratics.
I think that's a good account of emergence, though. Emergence is sort of the whole is more than the sum of the parts idea.
Exactly.
Where some property is not simply reducible to other properties. It's dependent on those properties, so the mind is dependent on the brain, but it's more than or not simply reducible to.
And that's where Aristotle, you might disagree with him in his teleology, but there's something about his notion of activity and power that has its own natural constraints in just the most everyday form of it, that there are boundaries to activity and that those boundaries are part of what makes an entity, a thing a thing. And it's the transition through those boundaries that distinguishes them.
Yeah.
So you want to read a lot of Heraclitus, Seth?
No, I'm just struck by what you're asking for. I started recently listening to a podcast called The History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps.
Yeah, I've heard of that, yeah.
The Without Any Gaps is part of the title?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it's called The History of Philosophy on iTunes, but it's a guy at King's College in London, Peter Adamson, and he's trying to go through the history of Western philosophy without any gaps. So he starts off at the very beginning and he keeps going through the pre-Socratics, Zeno and Pythagoras and Democritus, and Pericles, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A good portion, apparently, of their time was spent arguing about those very problems you describe. Like, what is becoming and how do things change from one form or another? And what is the nature of things in the world such that they can make that kind of change, right? So when one of them says, well, it's water or it's fire or it's earth, or there's no change whatsoever, it's only apparent change, right? The great Parmenides versus Heraclitus debate. And it sounds like those questions are still with us. We have a different language to speak about them now. So we have emergence and properties and all sorts of other things. Those are the fundamental questions of philosophy.
Yeah, and actually this is one of Merleau-Ponty's critics in this conversation brings up exactly the pre-Socratics as sort of pointing to the nature of science. This is on page 104 and 105, by the way. He says, could we have constructed your science if Anaximenes or Anaximander had not said, this is perception, we do not believe in it, the true reality is air or fire, and so on and so forth. So typically science is trying to point to these underlying hidden realities, and what we get is these sort of confused sensations or perceptions, and we have to try and make sense of it. And Merleau-Ponty doesn't, I don't think his response to that is all that enlightening.
Could maybe I shift so we have a little more discussion of the humanistic upshot? All these guys, Heidegger and Sartre, they end up being some kind of existentialist, and we've hinted at their views in these areas. But you can listen to our Camus episode to get the gist of existentialism. You know, there's anxiety, there's nausea, there's all this that with this perspectivism comes a kind of unbalancing. And I really see Merleau-Ponty, from the evidence that we've gotten in here, as a much gentler version of all those things, right? I mean, he wants to argue, like Sartre does, for human freedom, just pointing at these paradoxes, right? The fact that all these different perspectives available make perception itself paradoxical, make the world paradoxical. And we could even see ourselves sort of absurdly in the way that Camus seems to. You know, we have these perspectives that we adopt to get things done from a practical matter, but then, you know, we can look at ourselves from the outside, we can abstract, and these things look kind of ridiculous. So at the end of one of his lectures in The Will to Perception, Man Seen from the Outside, about page 89, he says, to look at human beings from the outside is what makes the mind self-critical and keeps it sane. The aim should not be to suggest that all absurd, as Voltaire did. It is much more a question of implying, as Kafka does, that human life is always under threat, and of using humor to prepare the ground for those rare and precious moments at which human beings come to recognize and to find one another. So it ends up being this, the function of philosophy is not to uncover these metaphysical issues. He ultimately is not going to care that much about ontology. It's about relating to other people and doing this not through dismissing reflection and saying philosophy is irrelevant from the, you know, no, we need to go and analyze our experience in this way. But it's ultimately to connect with each other better than we otherwise could, whereas we might not recognize that we could adopt someone else's viewpoint or something like that without reflection, realizing compassion, realizing responsibility, realizing freedom. And none of this leads to some sort of existential angst. Did you not leave thinking warm and fuzzy thoughts like that?
Well, it's always seemed to me that the existential angst, it's always a nihilism born out of missing the absolute, right? It's only born out of missing a particular kind of certainty.
Right. If there's no God, then all is permitted. Mm-hmm. That kind of, if my destiny is not predetermined by my human nature, then my freedom is absolute and scary. That's a Sartrean kind of notion. Yeah. And what you just said about the absolute, Dylan, the very last paragraph of The Primacy of Perception is the closest he gets here to talking about philosophy of religion. Let me give just half that paragraph. There is no destruction of the absolute or of rationality here, only of the absolute and the rationality separated from experience. To tell the truth, Christianity consists in replacing the separated absolute by the absolute in men, right? Saying Jesus is a man, is God. Nietzsche's idea that God is dead is already contained in the Christian idea of the death of God. God ceases to be an external object in order to mingle in human life. And this life is not simply returned to a non-temporal conclusion. God needs human history. As Malebranche said, the world is unfinished. So we don't need to miss the absolute because the absolute is in us. But we don't want to mistake his kind of humanism That's what the emphasis on dogs and insane people and the uncivilized is for, that we don't want to mistake humanism as like Protagoras. The world revolves around our own preferences because he's far too aware that these are all historically contingent and they're especially contingent upon the peculiarities of our human bodies.
Yeah. And so that goes back to why I find, as interesting as I find this kind of thing, I find it sort of ultimately dissatisfying because it doesn't look sort of forward or doesn't look towards articulating what we ought to be doing. In some funny way, it's not doing the activity that, as a process, something like other theoretical activities do. It's reflecting on itself without generating new theoretical material to work with. The way in which the response for a scientist is to come up with a new theory about how the world works and argue about how that works, understanding that it might turn out to be true, it might not turn out to be true, basing that on the best understanding that scientist has about the facts and what's come before and what he sees now. And it seems like all that is possible from what Marilou Ponty is talking about for philosophy and morality and that kind of thing. But it just kind of stops with wanting to emphasize the refinability of it. It would be as if a scientist spent all their time writing papers saying, science is refinable. You don't have the final answer right now. And every scientist is saying, yes, of course, that's why I have a job, right? I mean,
is yes. this a critique of philosophy in general or Merleau-Ponty?
I don't know about philosophy in general. I guess it's why I find it's simultaneously very interesting and dissatisfying. I had the same problem with someone like Rorty. I guess maybe I'm just tired of it. Maybe it was more innovative at some point.
Mm. I think that's definitely true. There was a historical, there was a zeitgeist where the point of view had a lot of power. And maybe that's passed, or maybe it's changed, or maybe we have a different set of historical challenges in front of us that lessens the power of that particular point of view.
So maybe I should try to reproduce for myself the power of Descartes, that in some ways Merleau-Ponty is calling himself as an heir and a foil to Descartes to try to refine that in some way. And the certainty of rational knowledge, he wants to deny it in some important way, which I'm very sympathetic with. But I find myself trying to reproduce the notion of certainty that isn't obviously merely a kind of political dogmatism. And maybe that's just what I'm missing, where the certainty of rationality bleeds into political dogmatism and authoritarianism in a straightforward way. And it becomes extraordinarily important to separate that authoritarianism from the scientific enterprise.
Merleau-Ponty almost has a comeback from at least the first part of what you said there. On page 114 of The Primacy of Perception, he's answering one of his interlocutors. And he says, lived experience is of immediate interest only to those who are interested in the human. I've never hoped that my work would be of much interest to the physicist as physicist. But your complaint could as well be addressed to all works of philosophy. That what phenomenology is doing is not innovating, and it's not trying to give an explanation. It's not trying to get behind phenomena. It's just trying to get phenomena and put them in a perspective. And if all that means to the physicist as physicist is, oh, the results of physics should be defeasible, then yeah, that's not going to be very informative. It seems like he is still stuck in some version of Husserl's overall project of we need to ground philosophy. And he has his specific humanistic reasons for doing that are the ones I've already said, is because a lot of strains of sort of bad philosophy based on science are these scientism, as Wes constantly complains about, but also just
constantly
thinking that science is dehumanizing, or just these pictures of, you know, you hear these in documentaries about World War One and crap like this. It's like he's trying to shift the geist of the time. And if you think that the Industrial Revolution and World War One and all this stuff have put us all in this state of panic and meaninglessness and we all feel like cogs in the machine, he's...
Yeah, that's not the scientism complaint, though.
But it's a related... It's a complaint about philosophy as a characterization of the emotional tone of the ideas and structures of your society. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
If you ask people what their philosophy is, they say, I believe in taking each day as it comes, or I believe that there's a bright side to everything, or something. Like, that's ultimately, that's a very crude philosophy, but that's ultimately what philosophy is how are you going to look at life? what is the best perspective to adopt? And I think this is what he's trying to do. He's trying to just give us a perspective. And I guess I don't see much wrong with what he's got down here. I'm not sure I understand or really think that it amounts to a fully fledged theory. I want to read more about, again, this stuff about the body. Yeah. And I don't feel like we have the story, but the outline, as he set forth, looks fine to me.
Is it really whatever's going to get you through the night? Is it really John Lennon's philosophy?
No, it's not, because he has these nuance. He's already said, made these more nuanced positions about, for instance, ethics, that yes, there's something relativist about ethics because it's human based.
Yeah.
But the fact that we are humans living in this society means that we're committed to certain ethical, you know, a pretty detailed ethical viewpoint, etc.
My problem is if there's something to the body subject that can be explained, that my experience, and it's been so long since I really delved into Merleau-Ponty, University of Texas, and like most of what I did there, it wasn't like productive. I didn't get...
You skipped that day.
No, I did it, but I didn't... I think I had to do a presentation, but I didn't get a lot out of it then. And now, to me, just from what we've read for tonight, it just has that sort of, it's a nice slogan, or the body subject, you know, let's make sure we concentrate on the embodiedness of the subject and not treat them as merely this disembodied spirit and so on and so forth. Those are great little slogans and aspirations, but for me to be satisfied, I need a richer explanation. That may be there in Merleau-Ponty. Frankly, I suspect it isn't. I suspect it's simply this sort of encouragement towards seeing the subject as embodied, and that's where it stops. That bothers me if that's the case. If there's something richer there, if there's an actual explanation of how we get to the embodied subject and how that works, then fantastic.
That sounds like a call to our educated listening audience to comment on the blog to this posting for this episode, to tell us what we're missing. And if you think that we need to have another episode on this dude to read the good stuff, maybe. Any other closings?
No, I think I'm good.
Well, it's been a pleasure chatting with y'all. Next time, we're going to be talking about Foucault, Michel Foucault's, some portion of his book, Discipline and Punish. We were thinking, what, chapters 1, 2, and 5?
We'll post it.
Look on partiallyexaminedlife.com for details of that. Please go there for discussion. Please give us a nice review on iTunes if you'd like. You can follow us on Twitter. Our Facebook group is crazily active right now. You should get on there and jump in, even on things completely irrelevant to what we're talking about. But we will be posting things relevant to this that we learn on partiallyexaminedlife.com. And that's all I got. We accept your donations graciously. Always end with the money pitch, man.
When Mark says crazily active, he doesn't just mean very active.
It is no mere perception of activity. It's genuine activity.
Genuinely fucking crazy.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Write me love, 'cause I'm just a wannabe, just a jerk who doesn't deserve to bleed. 'Cause we all know what we like already, and our afraid of that is full. Well, I'm not a shill or a corporate fool, and I'm probably not what you mean by cool. As a piece of meat, I just can't compete, though I try like many others. just a wannabe. Well, your taste may be cheap, but your choice is still free. It takes so much less effort to go stuff through than to look out for something that's uniquely. Write me off because that's what people do when confronted by something the slightest bit new. And I don't know why I can't change your mind, though I try like many others. How will anything make you listen to me? Can I get this out of my system?